TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. How the West Caused the Crisis in Ukraine. Part 2. Rick Rusoff on the Role of NATO. Rick Rusoff begins this broadcast by acknowledging Professor John Mersheimer. You heard his talk in the last program by TUC Radio. Both Rusoff and Mersheimer call what is going on in Ukraine from most of 2013 to the present a war, a term with huge geopolitical implications. It is widely acknowledged that the expansion eastward of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, is a major provocation of Russia and a huge and underreported factor in the origins and the conduct of that war. Few investigative journalists follow the day-to-day politics of NATO, directed largely by the U.S., as closely as Rick Rusoff. A graduate in European literature turned peace activist, Rusoff is the manager of the organization Stop NATO International. Here's Rick Rusoff.
It's a pleasure to be here. It's an honor to share the panel with Professor Mersheimer. Professor Mersheimer did correctly identify the crisis in Ukraine right now as a war. It is a war. Today is day 270 of what the regime in Kiev refers to euphemistically as an anti-terrorist operation. 270 days of armed conflict in Europe. I had occasion earlier to categorize the crisis, I think quite in keeping with what we all believe, is the fifth act in a tragedy whose title is NATO expansion. And as was mentioned by Dr. Mersheimer, in 1999, the first time in the post-Cold War era, the U.S., on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of the foundation of its military bloc, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, held for the first time a summit in the United States in Washington, D.C., which marked simultaneously not only the jubilee anniversary of NATO and the fact that a NATO summit was held in the United States. Keep in mind, this is a military alliance that, in theory, was to protect Europe from Soviet expansion, but it's held now in Washington, D.C. in 1999, against the backdrop of the first post-Cold War expansion of that organization, where Poland, the Czech Republic, and Hungary were brought in. Poland borders the Kaliningrad Oblast, which is part of Russian territory. So for the first time outside of Norway, we have a country that borders Russia brought into a U.S.-dominated military alliance. At the same time, NATO is conducting its first war, a 79-day air war against the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. In the interim, the so-called North Atlantic Treaty Organization has conducted wars in three continents. In Europe with Yugoslavia for 13 years in Afghanistan and Asia, and against Libya 4 years ago in Africa. At its latest summit in Wales in the United Kingdom last year, not only were there 28 members of NATO, represented, and the expansion we're talking about, from 1999 to 2009, 2009, Albania and Croatia were brought in, so that you had 12 nations joining NATO in a decade. That's a 75% increase in its membership in the Cold War period. It would have been 13, by the way, if except for the lingering name dispute between Greece and Macedonia. Macedonia would have been the third, incorporated in 2009. But at the Wales summit last year, in addition to representatives from the 28 full members of NATO, there are representatives from 49 partner countries. Do the arithmetic. At 77 countries, that's well over a third, closer to a half of the nations in the United Nations, members of the United Nations, belonging to a U.S.-led military bloc. I think one of the things we need to be very cautious about, and it was alluded to in the previous talk, is I believe that only government officials in the West, but certainly the mainstream media, are guilty of not only distorting, but inverting or reversing chronology and causality when they talk about the Ukrainian crisis. For example, You know, it's a sort of self-exculpatory claim in the West, as Dr. Mearsheimer is alluding to. Good thing we expanded NATO, now we're prepared to deal with the crisis in the Ukraine. When in fact, you know, the current Poroshenko government has announced they are scrapped, or the Verkhovna Rada, the parliament, is scrapping their erstwhile neutral status in terms of military bloc. Ukraine has never been neutral since the fragmentation of the Soviet Union. In February of 1994, Ukraine became the first former Soviet republic outside of the three Baltic states, which, you know, occupy a somewhat anomalous position, to join the so-called Partnership for Peace, which was a transitional program the Clinton administration and NATO elaborated in order to effect the expansion I talked about a second ago. That is to bring 12 new members into NATO, all of them in Eastern Europe, with the exception of Croatia and Slovenia, which were former federal republics of Yugoslavia, all of them former members of the Warsaw Pact, to the point where roughly a decade ago, then-President George W. Bush made an allusion to the fact, I'm probably quoting him almost word for word, that the Warsaw Pact is now NATO. And what that means is from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea, the entire western flank of Russia, increasingly the southern flank of Russia, is being shored up by NATO expansion. In 2008, at the Bucharest summit, I should mention, by the way, earlier that year, because it was a U.S. presidential election, that Georgian websites, this was the period of the Mikhail Saakashvili government in Tbilisi, reproduce letters from, at that time, senators, but also presidential candidates, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, John McCain, which are almost identical in phraseology. It was evident they came from a common source. They all ended with exactly a comment that I noticed Dr. Mearsheimer used in his article in Foreign Affairs, the catchphrase, Europe whole and free. And I think it's very important to realize the genesis of that expression, an alternate version of which is Europe whole, free, and at peace. That is an Orwellian inversion of the truth, I can assure you, the addition of the third term. In 1989, President George, the first George Bush, made a statement in Mainz, Germany, and this is, I believe, immediately before the collapse of the Berlin Wall and perhaps a year before German reunification. And the speech had that title, Europe Whole and Free. And it was clear that policymakers in the United States, but also their NATO allies in Europe, were envisioning some sort of continental system in Europe. And that continental system, let's be real clear about this, there is not a single nation, European nation, including the island nations, with the exception of the micro-states like Andorra, Liechtenstein, Vatican, Monaco, that has not either been a full member of NATO or a member of the Partnership for Peace program, and in many instances, several intermediate programs. There's one called the Membership Action Program is the penultimate one for entering NATO, and several countries, particularly in the Balkans right now, have that status. Russia pulled out of the Partnership for Peace program in 1999 when the war against Yugoslavia was underway. Malta, the small island nation in the Mediterranean, temporarily pulled out because of a change in government, was reabsorbed, and the only nation that is standing out in all of Europe is the tiny island nation of Cyprus, which is now headed towards a Partnership for Peace. So what we're talking about is the entirety of Europe being subordinated to a military bloc controlled from the other side of the Atlantic, and nothing less. In his article, Professor Mearsheimer talked about the Eastern Partnership Program, which is vital to understand because this is the real precipitant for the crisis in Ukraine, the immediate precipitant. In 2008, Sweden and Poland, and we're talking about Foreign Minister at that time in Sweden, Carl Bildt, Foreign Minister at that time of Poland, Radoslaw Sikorski, who had lived in the United States, is married to an American journalist, worked for the Heritage Foundation, and so forth, crafted the Eastern Partnership, which was meant transparently to wean from the Commonwealth of Independent States, that is the essentially economic bloc that was thrown as a sop to Russia after the fragmentation of the Soviet Union, was meant, and it targeted all the former Soviet federal republics, excepting the Baltic states, which by that time had already joined both NATO and the European Union, and Russia itself, excluding the five Central Asian former Soviet republics for whom the EU has a comparable or an analogous program. But these countries that are targeted by the Eastern Partnership are Belarus, Armenia, Ukraine, Moldova, Georgia, Azerbaijan, those six. all formerly were members of the Commonwealth of Independent States. Georgia withdrew from that bloc after the August 2008 war with Russia. But what the European partnership effectively would do is to destroy any autonomous post-Soviet organizations within former Soviet space. It would supplant, for the Commonwealth of Independent States, the European Union. It was in November of 2013 when the Yanukovych government, I don't know that they so much scrapped what was called an association agreement with the European Union under the auspices of the Eastern Partnership, as they simply postponed formalizing that relationship, which was rectified in due order after the coup in Kiev, you can be assured. And then what happened was a series of protests, which resulted not only in the deaths of protesters, let's recollect, but in the deaths of 12 to 16 police officers who were killed. One could only imagine how a situation of that sort would be handled had it occurred in Washington, D.C., rather than Kiev in the Ukraine. When I mentioned that Ukraine has never been fully neutral, let me explain what that is. Though anything short of evidently 100% loyalty is not to be tolerated, the Kuchma government, Leonid Kuchma government, that is three governments removed right now, supplied almost 1,700 troops to the George W. Bush administration for the occupation of Iraq after the invasion in 2003 under what was called Multinational Forces Iraq, which was assisted by NATO. This was a goodwill gesture or a token of commitment, if you will, for NATO integration. Subsequently, this very same government we now derogate and condemn, the Yanukovych government, became the first non-NATO power to supply a naval vessel for NATO's now permanent interdiction and surveillance operation in the Mediterranean Sea, Operation Active Endeavor. It then followed that up by being the first non-NATO country to supply a ship for NATO's permanent naval operation in the off the Horn of Africa in the Arabian Sea, Operation Desert Shield. Up until the change in the regime 11 months ago in Ukraine, Ukraine was to have been one of four non-NATO countries to supply military personnel and equipment for NATO's response force, that is, its international strike force, in essence. The others were, revealingly, Georgia, Finland, and Sweden. So we see that, far from Yanukovych, the Yanukovych government in any way being hostile to NATO, he seemed, in my estimate, to be completely and unjustifiably accommodating to NATO. During the course even of the Yanukovych government, the yearly summer breeze NATO war games in the Crimean Peninsula continued to occur. The annual Rapid Trident military exercises in the west of the country, NATO exercises, continued to occur. So what we have in Ukraine right now is that, I should step back a moment. I also feel that, there's a special irony in presenting the Russian government as being, aggressive in this context or being overly protective. Let's use a term that's been used for several decades in reference to Russian foreign policy, paranoid. Along the lines of what, Professor Mearsheimer was talking about, were one to... if turnabout is fair play, and if every nation of the Western Hemisphere was brought into a Russian-dominated military bloc, I don't believe we would be paranoid in suspecting we were the likely target of that military expansion. And that's the same thing with Russia. But the association agreement of the Eastern Partnership with Ukraine, the rejection of which triggered the now 270-day war in that country, it's been ratified. Now, it contains a very strong military component. And it would effectively intensify the integration of Ukraine into Western military structures. We have to recall that in the 1990s, in addition to the Partnership for Peace, launched in 1994, there was also a NATO program called Mediterranean Dialogue, which takes in seven countries in North Africa and in the Middle East. There's, the summit in Chicago, the NATO summit in Chicago 2012, a NATO partnership which I think has the most revealing title, Partners Across the Globe. In Afghanistan for 13 years under the structure of the International Security Assistance Force, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization managed to integrate military forces from 50 nations and every inhabited continent. This is unparalleled in history, as is any military bloc containing 77 members and partners and so forth. This is what we have to see as the backdrop against which, you know, the crisis in Ukraine is occurring. We also have to know that as early as 2006, during the then George W. Bush administration, that successive heads of the Missile Defense Agency of the United States paid visits, initially surreptitiously, afterwards publicly met with officials of the Viktor Yushchenko government and talked about incorporating Ukraine into the U.S.'s European and ultimately global missile defense system. That there was talk about either interceptor missiles being stationed in Ukraine or missile radar facilities being stationed there. I assume that's probably back on the drawing board right now. The other countries mentioned, by the way, you know, in 2006, 2008, were Georgia and Turkey. Turkey now has a long-range missile radar facility placed there as of 2 years ago. And the I want to say one last word, though, on the question of the 2008 Bucharest summit, because I forgot to follow up on it. At the time, as Professor Mearsheim was talking about, Georgia and Ukraine were promised full NATO partnership once they met the basic preconditions for that. And what the two major preconditions are: no territorial disputes or unresolved armed conflicts on the soil of the nation, you know, a candidate member, aspirant member. Number two, no foreign military personnel stationed on their territory, by which I think we could safely assume no non-NATO military personnel. Because when Cyprus joins the Partnership for Peace program, as it's going to do shortly, the fact that there are Turkish military personnel in the north of the country will in no way impede you know, Cyprus being brought into a NATO partnership program. So we had the cases, was alluded to earlier, that Georgia had two unresolved territorial disputes in Abkhazia and South Ossetia. Ukraine did not technically have one of what are referred to as frozen conflicts, but I think Crimea in many ways arguably was the fifth frozen conflict. Because it did it does contain the Black Sea Fleet, you know, which Russia had, in, you know, going back decades before the Soviet Union, so this is not a Soviet phenomenon. And the I would suspect that in the military, if not the political establishment in Moscow, there was a suspicion that after the the change of power in February of last year, that it was a matter of time before their Black Sea Fleet received an eviction notice. And I think that may very well be one of the reasons that Russia struck first, to the extent it did at all. So a couple things I think we have to keep in mind here is that, and let me just, because I know I've heard from people, I was on a Russian debate with Michael O'Hanlon from the Brookings Institution, who accused me of gross and unconscionable exaggeration in terms of NATO buildup in Eastern Europe since the crisis in Ukraine ensued. And he was talking about, you know, minor, you know, military drills and so forth. In March of last year, in last year's iteration of a NATO exercise called Cold Response, it was held in the Arctic Circle, roughly 200 miles from Russian territory. It included over 16,000 troops from 16 nations, including Sweden and Finland. And again, you know, along the lines of the you know, the allegory that Dr. Mearsheimer mentioned, not to worry, right? I mean, there's no reason for Russia to be concerned about 16,000 troops in major war games a couple of hundred miles from their border. I believe it's incumbent on us, first of all, to realize that I'm afraid at this point, intractable. I would like to believe the formula that was offered earlier, wise as it is, you know, will be acted upon, and we can retreat from what is, you know, potentially a very dangerous confrontation. I should let you know that both of us panelists objected to the original title that was proposed for this talk, which included words to the effect of, you know, nuclear war or something. However, I woke up this morning to see somebody not noted for ever having been, you know, tremendously confrontational with the West, former Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev, talk about just that prospect. I don't know if anyone saw that today. We talked about the crisis potentially, you know, which had the potential to spin out of control and eventually lead to a nuclear war. So I don't believe that's a distinct prospect, but we shouldn't even discuss the, you know, the percentages on that one. This is something that is fraught with that potential. It's dangerous beyond all comprehension. We need to step back. We need rationality. I'll go a step further, though, in my proposal. We not only need to call for immediate halt to NATO expansion, we need to call for the abolition of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which I consider the biggest threat to world peace.
That was Rick Rusoff. He spoke on January 10, 2015, along with Professor John Mersheimer from the University of Chicago. Their topic is How the West Caused the Crisis in Ukraine. Rick Rousseff lives and works in Chicago and has been an active opponent of war, militarism, and intervention for over 40 years. He writes on the threat of international militarization, especially on the globalization of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO. Rousseff's talk was followed by a lively Q&A session. The first question was, how have Obama and his administration handled Ukraine? The first responding voice is that of Professor John Mersheimer.
I made clear, and I believe Rick made clear in his comments, NATO expansion, which is the principal driving force behind this crisis, began in the Clinton administration. The first tranche was, as he pointed out, and I believe I did too, in 1999. I think the second major tranche was 2004, right? And in 2008, remember we both talked about the April 2008 Bucharest conference, the NATO conference, where they said that Ukraine and Georgia would become part of NATO. That was under George W. Bush, right? And of course, Barack Obama has been in the driver's seat over the course of the 2013-2014 period. So there's really no one president who bears responsibility for this. It's a whole string of presidents who have been acting according to the same basic logic that has precipitated this crisis.
I'm wondering if I may say something.
I don't want this to pass unnoticed. The question about the Ukrainian people's will. You know, I find it very interesting that in 2010, a presidential election, a runoff election, granted there's a multi-party system in Ukraine, it's far more democratic than our own, or was, until the current junta started purging political parties that didn't agree with it. You've seen the YouTube videos of some of the great freedom fighters and democracy advocates beating up journalists in their office, assaulting members of parliament, and so forth. This is something, you know, evocative of Germany in the early 1930s, not of a democratic government. But there was to have been a presidential election in March of this year. The Ukrainian people voted in a runoff election in 2010 for Viktor Yanukovych. The only facts we have available to us is how people vote. And if people in Ukraine had changed their opinion on Mr. Yanukovych, they only had to wait 11 months to vote him out. Instead of burning down parts of the capital city, throwing Europe into a crisis, and starting off a 270-day war. I don't believe, outside of a few nationalist extremists in the northwest part of the country, anyone in Ukraine desired that.
That was Rick Rousseff. The next question was, is the military-industrial complex driving the NATO expansion? And why does Europe go along? Rick Rousseff.
Is expansion of NATO into Europe to further the economic interests of the military-industrial complex? That's a question I believe I heard. My answer then is in part, and maybe even in major part. Let me explain. Today, the Polish press announces that four Polish MiG-19s are being deployed to the Baltics as part of what's called the NATO Air Patrol. This is something that was instituted within days of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania being brought into NATO in 2004. So it's continued for 11 years. Initially, there were four advanced kind of new generation warplanes provided by different countries rotating. There are currently 16. That is, the number of warplanes in Lithuania and Estonia, NATO warplanes, has been quadrupled. However, that's going to be the last MiG plane that Poland ever flies, because at the beginning of this century, the subservient government in Warsaw signed a deal with the United States to purchase 48 F-16s. That's a colossal expenditure. It's the largest single military purchase in Polish history, bar none, and that's not the end of it. Immediately afterwards, the U.S. tried to entice Bulgaria and Romania, who had joined NATO in 2004, Poland 5 years earlier, to purchase from 24 to 36 F-16s each. That didn't materialize because of the economic downturn of 2008. But, you know, the fact is, yes, not only American merchants of death, if you will, you know, arms manufacturers, but the European arms manufacturers are cleaning up on this. With NATO expansion over the last 15 years, Germany, as of recently, last time I saw, is the third largest arms exporter in the world. Sweden is a major exporter of arms and has participated actively in NATO's last two wars. I don't know if people know these things. Sweden had several hundred troops still to this day serving under NATO in Afghanistan in the first armed conflict in 200 years in that nation's history. You know, serving along with Finnish troops who have not been involved in combat since World War II. Swedish Gripen airplanes participated in the air war against Libya. And there's one fellow in particular in Sweden, an American expatriate named Al Burke. I invite you to look him up. He has a website called Help Stop Sweden's Furtive Accession to NATO. And, you know, you can read this. Go do a Google News search on Sweden and NATO day by day. You know, each day the numbers are inching up of the amount of Swedes ready to support integration into NATO as a full member state. There, you know, the Ukraine crisis is being used to create the panic necessary. Some of you may have seen the statement by a military official in Sweden a little while ago that the Russians could be in Stockholm in 20 minutes at the rate of our military. You know, I mean, these. No, the second part of your question. Why are the Europeans going along with this? They're making a lot of money from weapons. And we have to acknowledge that Russia has basically two export products. They have arms and they have hydrocarbons. And when you prevent them from selling arms to Europe because of NATO interoperability regulations, which says that any NATO member or any NATO candidate member can only purchase arms that are interoperable with American, German, French, British, Swedish, and other Western arms, then you effectively cut Russia out of the arms market in Europe. If the European Union, which is the second largest consumer of energy in the world next to the United States, and has been receiving 25 or 30% of its natural gas from Russia, now, if Russia is cut out of that market because of the Ukraine crisis, and by the way, the Yushchenko government, when it was in power a few years ago, started a reverse flow process with natural gas, which was the beginning of the process of squeezing Russia out of the European energy market. This is economic warfare. This is targeting a government to say, essentially, your major export products are not going to your major market. And I can assure you again, if the situation were reversed, we'd deal with that in a pretty firm manner.
That was Rick Rusoff, preeminent investigator of the expansion of NATO, a topic rarely covered in the U.S. media. Rusoff spoke, along with Professor John Mersheimer of the University of Chicago, at an event organized by Evanston Neighbors for Peace. Rusoff blogs at rickrusoff.wordpress.com. Rusoff is spelled R-O-Z-O-F-F. There's a link on TUC Radio's website. Come back for another section of this event with Q&A for Professor Mersheimer. It may include one or two questions that you would like to have had answered if you had been there. Thanks to Dale Lehman, news director of the iconic Wizard, WZDR Radio in Chicago. He recorded this event on January 10, 2015. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. If you're unable to download online, you can get an audio CD at cost on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening.